Does Satan have a plan to install the Antichrist at the end of days? And if so, how close are we to all of that? In a moment, Gary Wayne joins us, author of the Genesis 6 Conspiracy. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Gary Wayne is a Christian contrarian who has maintained a lifelong love affair with biblical prophecy, history, mythology. His extensive study has encompassed some of the Bible, Gnostic scriptures as well, the Quran, the Bhagavad Gita, the Gilgamesh, and other ancient epics and secret society publications. Gary, welcome to the program. First time for you, isn't it?
First time, and so happy to be here tonight.
I'm looking forward to that, too. And how did I pronounce that? Bhagavad Gita, is that how you pronounce it?
You did it very, very well. It's one of those tongue twisters that...
is that Indian?
Over. Yes, that's the Eastern Vedas and Upanishads and various religious books. So
Your interest echoes much of mine as well, and I want to read the subtitle of your book because it's very important. The title is The Genesis 6 Conspiracy, but listen to this, folks. How secret societies and the descendants of giants plan to enslave mankind. That's scary, Gary.
Yeah, it's quite a catchy little title, I think, and it goes right to sort of the heart of the whole book that I wrote. And it's a, you know, just to say a little bit about the book so people have a understanding of what we're talking about, is it's a 6,000-year investigation into, you know, a connect-the-dot investigation into how the giants that are created in Genesis 6, how they're created, how they partner with the descendants of Cain, who developed the seven sacred sciences and the illicit knowledge from the Watchers, how they developed the mystical religions and the secret societies, and how those partner to usurp the kingships and enslave the antediluvian world, how those peoples and organizations crossed the flood, how they affected early post-diluvian history, how they affected our history, what they're doing today, and what they're planning to do to bring about the end time.
And the end times might be closer than we think, isn't it?
Well, it seems to be. I mean, I don't put dates on things. As you know, there's a very large graveyard of people who predict those dates and have been wrong. But I think as we approach the end times, and I think they're on the horizon, there's still a lot of things yet to come together, but I think we can see those things coming together.
A lot of people, too, Gary, have predicted the rapture wrongly and got a lot of people scared and upset over things like that, too.
Yeah, and it really disrupts the credibility of prophecy. And we're told that nobody knows the hour, but we do know the seasons and we do know the times and to watch for the signs. So not all of those signs and things are yet in place, but they are forming.
Let's talk about how you got interested in this research, first of all, to even write the book, The Genesis 6 Conspiracy.
Yeah, so in the late 70s, I had a brother who challenged me to read a book called The Late Great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey.
Oh, yeah. Good
and
book.
I was already a mystery history buff and a mythology buff at that point. It was really my passion. But when I read the book by Hal, I had to figure out whether or not what he was saying was accurate or not. And that's really how I come about everything I do as being a contrarian, is I try and verify things for myself as opposed to what's written and what other people say. So as I begin to check that out, I was quite astonished at the accuracy of what Hal was talking about and what was written in the Bible. And that led me back to become a Christian and to research the Bible and to log all the different prophecy narratives that are in the Bible. But along the way, as you start detailing in that manner all the different narratives and things, you keep running across the giants.
Mm-hmm.
Begins in Genesis 6. They show up after the flood. And then they just kind of disappear and they're not talked about again. But in end time prophecy, you have a significant amount of references that go back to the days of Noah. You have the abyss with the angels being released. You have demons coming out of the mouths of the Antichrist and the false prophet. And you have all of these connections back to Genesis 6. And so I thought what I would do is write my first book, which would be the shortest book, is what the plan was, about how you can connect prehistory to end time and prophecy. Mm-hmm. But along the way, as I continued to research, it's turned out to be the longest book I'll probably ever write. It's over 800 pages with over 120 pages of endnotes. I started to connect in history and mythology to it to see what other cultures and religions had to say about it. And that kept up opening up doors. And once I dug into the deeper levels of that, went down the rabbit hole, I got into the secret societies and their history and linked that in. And then all of a sudden it turned into this significantly larger book and more of a conspiracy book than what I had intended to do. But what I do in my book is I tell not only the biblical side, but I tell those stories and let the other side, whether or not it's a secret society or a different religion, tell their own story and show how that matches up with what the Bible says.
Yeah, you balance it pretty well.
Yeah, and I wanted to have balance. I mean, to get published, though, you have to do it with a bias, so I went with my natural bias. But I do want to have people understand that what is talked about in the Bible is not a standalone account either of prehistory or of history or as what is about to happen in the end times. This is talked about all over the earth, just as the accounts of prehistory is a common legacy of human history, just told through different parallel lenses of the same account.
And Gary, let me ask you this then. Let's talk about the giants first and their importance in this story. Are we talking about the Nephilim? Is that the same thing?
Yes, they are. So if you're looking at the King James Version Bible, it says giants. If you look at more modern translations, it'll say Nephilim. And that's because giants goes back to Hebrew as Nephil, or the fallen ones, and or a tribe of giants. And so when we're talking about giants, we're talking biblically about the Nephilim. Now, they'll take on other names after the flood, like Rephaim, or Abim, or Emim, or Zamzuzim, and Horim, and many, many other names after the flood, but they all connect back to the initial race out of Genesis 6.
Were these Satan's soldiers? How were they created?
Well, the biblical account demonstrates that it was the sons of God or the angels of God and the rebellious ones, and as the book of Enoch will back up and call them watchers, they went to the daughters of humans and procreated with them to create these giants. And we see this as a similar story that's told all over the world. So let's say if you take out of the Atlantean mythology and as Plato will record in Critias or Timaeus, Poseidon goes to climbing, produces 10 Titan giant kings that are going to rule over the Atlantean Empire. So this is kind of one of those commonalities, these common histories that is all over the world.
Now, these giants, can you kind of describe what they look like?
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of people, when they think about giants, they think maybe they're 7 feet tall or they're 8 feet tall. Well, these were monsters, and they're described as monsters in other accounts that's outside the Bible. So you can imagine that most people will, in the field, will say 20 to 40 feet was probably the size of the original ones.
Jeez.
Biblically, though, we can't make that case. What we can do is make the case that if you take Goliath, which is over 2,000 years after the first creation of the giants and after the flood, if you use a common cubit of 18 inches, he's going to be about 9 feet 9 inches.
That's pretty big.
Yeah, and if you use the royal cubit, he'd be 11 feet 3 inches. And because Goliath would have been a king of Gath, and all of the giants were kings for the most part, probably you should use the royal cubit in the measurements. And using that same sort of measurement, you have King Og at the time of Moses, who had a bed that would have been using those measurements between 15 and 16 feet. which would have put him somewhere probably between 13 and 14 feet tall. And it was made of iron because wood would not hold his weight.
You don't have any doubts of their existence, do you?
No, I don't. It is in all cultures, all religions, all mythologies on all continents except for Antarctica, and who knows what we might discover down the road in Antarctica, that tells about these giants. It's that sort of common history that is part of the flood, just as you have pyramids all around the world. And these giants just weren't tall. Where the average height to width ratio of a human is 3-to-1, these were 2-to-1. So they were very, very stocky, very, very muscular.
Right.
And they were huge.
Almost ape-like.
Almost ape-like. But they were also very dexterous with their hands and their feet, as you get told in Greek mythology. These were warriors. These weren't sideshow freaks. These were...
What did their faces look like? I mean, did they look human?
Yeah, so they didn't, not in the beginning. And that's because the angel class that created them were the seraphim angels that's recorded in Isaiah. These are angels that are called watchers or Gregorian in other accounts. And these angels are known as the fiery serpent angels, because seraphim angels surround the throne of God in the fiery stones, and are one of the highest ranking angels. But they had the face of a snake. And so when you hear of angelic angels with the face of a snake and wings, you have a godlike dragon, so to speak. Just as serpents before Eden were also known as dragons and crocodiles, they're all the same thing. And before they lost their limbs and their legs, you would have had some that flew as well and would have been like a animal type of dragon. Now, the Nephilim looked just like them. So they had high cheekbones.
Were they born here?
Yes, they were born here, according to the Bible, yes. Okay. And most other accounts, unless you get into the alien mythos, which has a little bit different spin on it, which, of course, you'd be very, very familiar with.
True.
The Anunnaki. So they had high cheekbones, extended chins, slanted eyes. Their eyes glowed, and they were called the Shining Ones. Had thin lips. Most of them, according out of Northern mythology, would have had red hair and hazel eyes, and blonde hair and blue eyes.
Goliath had red hair, didn't he?
That's the general sort of understanding. There's nothing really to back that up other than out of legend, but that's typically what people suggest that they had. And what's interesting about that is you have, after the flood, two races of giants called the Tuatha De Danann, two branches. One is blonde hair and blue-eyed, one is red hair and hazel-eyed. One group goes up the Danube and into Russia and into Norway and into Sweden, and the other one goes over to Ireland. And then you also see these red-haired ones seemingly are linked somehow to migrating as they're being pushed out of the Middle East after the flood to North America, and that's why we see whether it's the skulls in Peru or the giant discoveries that are discovered in North America over the last 150 years, have this red hair connection, and I think that's not a coincidence.
Now, were these the giants that were wiped out during the Noah flood?
Yes, they were.
This is something that God destroyed.
Yeah, but again, in Genesis 6, we're told that there were at that time and also after. And we're not told biblically.
So some survived it.
Yes. We're not told how they survived the flood. But when you get into these names that I was talking about earlier, like the Rephaim and the Avim and the Horim and the Emin and on and on and on, these names of tribes of giants do not go back to the Table of Nations descending out of Noah and his three sons and wives in Genesis and First Chronicles. They just show up out of nowhere.
Where are they now, Gary?
Where are they now? Well, that's part of the whole sort of history is that they usurped the kingships both before and after the flood. And so you have two things going on. You have these dynasties of royal families coming down through history, and then you have the other ones that are being pushed out who aren't ruling over countries, and they're migrating around the world. But there are also giants that are told in bloodlines that go down not just out of the Middle East. That's just one strain of giants. So it doesn't matter whether or not you go to Japan or you go to India or you go to China or you go to the Kishimaya, they all have accounts of these giants with separate bloodlines around the world.
Now, when we talk, and we're going to jump ahead a little bit, then we'll come back, but that Satan has a plan to install the Antichrist at the end of days. How does this tie in with the giant's plan to enslave us?
One of the key things to understand is that these royal families have been trying to bring about a rendezvous with destiny over and over and over and over and over and over. And so they track their bloodlines. They intermarry. They track their genealogies. And they are trying to implant a descendant of these Nephilim that go back to the gods or the fallen angels that will accept the Antichrist crowning in the temple at the 3.5 point of the last 7 years. So it's their intention to present an Antichrist. Now, out of which bloodline it comes, that's a bit of a mystery because they're all trying to fight for the same sort of thing, even though they have a directional sort of strategy in terms of what they're trying to do. Everybody wants to have their Antichrist presented. And that's going to be one of the confusions that happens in the end time.
There's going to be many, right?
There's going to be many Antichrists, but at the end, there's only going to be one. And so one of the risks that...
Lucky us, right?
Yeah, lucky us. So whether it's the Mahdi from the Shia out of Islam, or it is Lord Maitreya out of the Eastern religions, there are many that are expected to come. And just as, you know, we're told from the secret societies in the West, they always keep three Antichrist figures ready to go, already illuminated into the secret knowledge, just waiting for the opportunity to present Antichrist.
Were the giants intelligent creatures?
Yeah, I think so. You know, they didn't have the wisdom to control their power, but I think they were very intelligent. I mean, even though you could impose your will because of the great size and dexterity and athletic abilities and warrior capabilities that they had, they still have to be able to rule. So I think they had significant intelligence, probably as good as what we had and more, or what we have and more, but they also had the partnership between the secret societies and the mystical religions in their governmental organizational structure to draw on, so they could implement this significant technology and knowledge alongside their kingship. Now, what we learn in all cultures as these Nephilim demigods rule is that they go from being a judicious reigning kings to terrible tyrants. And they begin to slaughter humankind. They war with each other. They drink human blood.
Oh, geez.
They eat humans.
Pure evil.
They turn into pure evil.
Hold on, Gary.
Why the flood comes about.
We'll come back with more in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Gary Wayne with us. His book, The Genesis 6 Conspiracy. Gary, with all this that we've been talking about, how does this tie into the Antichrist?
As we were talking before the break, is the Nephilim kingships, they usurped the kingships both before and after the flood and created the dynasties that ruled over the nation. So when you hear about, let's say, Nebuchadnezzar or the pharaohs of Egypt, they all take their bloodlines back to this the original copulation between the gods and human females, or, as we know it from the Christian perspective, the fallen angels. And they keep these genealogies, and their goal is to bring about the golden age of the antediluvian epoch. And as Francis Bacon would describe it, he called it the New Atlantis. And in the Atlantean world, you had not just the island continent, but 10 countries that the 10 Titan kings ruled over, and that was the Golden Age. That was the age that they want to bring back in the end time. And so they're trying to bring about the new Atlantis, but they also want to present an Antichrist figure that is going to rule over these 10 kings in the end time. And so it's through the bloodlines and the organizations of the mystical religions and the secret societies that all tend to work together that are trying to bring this about.
How successful might they be?
Well, I think they will be successful. I think we see the assembly going on right now, and even though it gets checked every now and then and slows up, that's only because the restrainer has not been removed. And biblically, it says until that restrainer is removed, they won't be able to fully put their agenda together, which is, you know, why that capstone on the pyramid in the secret societies isn't finished yet. And so what they're trying to do, though, is bring about a 10-nation empire. And this is going to be done through, not a 10-nation, but a 10-empire or groups of nations or trading blocks or spheres of influence, and to put their 10 bloodline descendants on those ruling governments. And there was a organization that was created in the late 60s called the Club of Rome that reports directly to...
Straight to the Pope, right?
Well, and to the Rosicrucians, which would be, you know...
Are they still around?
Same level. Yes, they are still around, absolutely.
I remember when I was a kid, in the back of newspapers, in classified ads or comic books, they advertised.
Yes.
It was weird.
Yeah, they're kind of at the sort of apex of the secret society, so above the Illuminati, above the adepts of the Freemasonry group. And most of the other organizations will funnel into them. And above them, at say about 50% of the Rosicrucians are going to be the purebloods, and then there's a higher level of organization above that. That's basically all reserved for the bloodline families. And so this Club of Rome that was created, their specific goal was to organize the world into 10 groups of nations. And they've already got that lined up as to what they want it to look like, whether or not it will essentially look the way they've got it lined up. We do know prophetically that it will come about, and that there will be 10 groups of nations or 10 empires that form the world government. That would be, you know, that 10 horns in Revelation, or the 10 toes in Daniel, that would describe those end time world government. And so world government is what they're after with their organizational structure, where they have the mystical religion that is set beside it, and they have a religion that's going to work with harmony with science. And that's the way it's been all the way through. And This is what's going to be set up, but you can't have the world government until the universal religion comes together, because that's what's going to bring the world together under one government that sort of is the glue to it.
Something will happen before that happens, though. That will scare them, right?
It will take catastrophes.
Yes.
And typically you're going to have the false prophets that are going to come out and make predictions that if you don't come together as one people with one language, under one government, under one religion, you're going to be destroyed from the face of the earth, just as you have that Babel syndrome from the time of Nimrod. And people are also going to be promised that if you come under this religion, under this world government, that will permit an opportunity to evolve into godhood or into a higher level of being and or intelligence.
Do you believe the Antichrist is on the planet now?
I think so, yeah. I think, as I said, I'm not a predictor of exactly when the end time comes, but I think it's on the horizon. And so I do believe that Antichrist would be out there right now. And I also think we're going to see these false prophets coming soon. And they're going to be from all over the world, but I might keep an eye out on the ones that were initiated in Medjugorje, that there were three children initiated in the 90s to come out. And their commission is to come out at a certain point in time and make 10 predictions. And each of the predictions as they go will become stronger and stronger and stronger and more horrific, that if people don't repent and convert to this religion, this catastrophe is going to happen. I also think we're going to need other catastrophes. I think we need the environmental catastrophes. We might need a nuclear catastrophe. And we may even have a, coming out of the fourth kind where we actually, meet and see the aliens that are just all over the media and all over the earth in terms of stories and things coming out. I think this is all going to be part of what drives people into coming together under one government.
Gary, will we be saved by them, or will we think we're being saved by them and they'll trick us?
They will offer godhood, they will offer knowledge, they will offer 1,000 years of peace, and
And we'll
everything
go
will,
for it.
and we'll go for it. And even at the point where we will see when Antichrist comes, it will seem like it's Armageddon.
That
But it
bad.
won't be. Yeah. It will be a horrific war. It'll be World War III. It'll be the Gog Magog War or the
Could be the
Dual
war to
War.
end all wars, though.
Yes, but it is still not yet Armageddon, but people will be deceived.
How do we know it's not Armageddon?
Well, that's how to discern it. And there's two different perspectives on it. There's the monotheist perspective on it, and then there's the other perspectives from the other groups and organizations that this is just what it's going to take to fight for freedom from the oppressive God of the Bible, so that there will be this new age where people will be free from this oppressive rule and free to become gods. So there's two distinct views. There's the monotheist way, where this is going to take care of the evil in the world, and then there's going to be a 1,000-year reign with Jesus, and then on to eternity. And then there's the other offer that is coming from the mystical religions and probably mixed in with the alien mythos, that this is part of what we have to do to fight for our freedom.
Are the aliens on the planet right now, and are they benevolent or not?
Well, I think they're on the planet, and I think there's a mix of things that are going in there in the alien mythos. There's many different kinds of aliens, and I believe there's the mixture of the gods and the fallen angels, and there's also the demon spirits of the original Nephilim that are involved. And I also think there are different kinds of beings that survived the flood, whether or not it's the small little aliens or it's the reptilians and all the other different sort of ones that make up. And I think they're here. And I think they've been waiting to make their presence known in a significant way. And I think we're getting closer to that all the time. And even, as you're probably well aware of, I mean, even the Vatican is waiting to baptize them into the
Right.
universal religion, right?
They did say they would do that.
They did say they would do that. So I think we're getting closer with that all of the time. It's
Why?
kind
What?
of like, oh, sorry.
No, you go ahead.
It's kind of like the Star Wars scenario when you mix in the alien aspect of it. And in the Star Wars scenario, you have the Jedi and fighting against the evil Empire, and that you the option that is going to be presented is that if you want to be free from the oppressive God of the Bible, which I firmly disagree with on that, but if you want to be free of that, you're going to have to fight for your freedom like the rebels in Star Wars. And so from a biblical perspective, we're looking at this as a totally different way as what the other people will look at. But there will be two significant different points of view going into the end time, and people will have to make their own decisions and discern and make a choice. And eventually, everybody has to make a choice who is still here, because you will either have to take a mark of loyalty with the mark of the beast or not. So at some point, everybody will have to make a decision, and it's really important to try and understand what's going on so that you're going to be comfortable with whatever decision you're going to make on that.
In the long run, with end times, the book of Revelation, things get better. You agree with that?
Yes. Yeah, after Armageddon sets up the 1,000-year reign of Jesus on earth, that is going to be set in complete contrast to the last 6,000 years from this of the descendants of Adam that took place before, that was full of wars, sin, violence, corruption. So it will be set as a comparative to the previous 6,000 years, and then after that, there's a new heavens and a new earth, and we go off into eternity.
Why does it seem that some of the groups that are associated with this connection, like the Templars and Freemasons, may be dabbling in something that's kind of evil?
Well, again, it all depends on what your perspective is, whether or not it's evil or not. They think that they are the sons of light and the children of light, and they are the inheritors of this ancient knowledge that was developed to a level that's higher than what we have today before the flood.
And why was the flood so important, Gary? I mean, to wipe them out?
It was to, for the most part, wipe them out, but it was to give humankind a second chance and the world a second chance to make a free choice to choose God and to present the Messiah through the nation of Israel, which would permit humankind to be raised above angels in the future time. And so it's what happened in the flood is that the antediluvian world is absolutely corrupted and taken off course. And it's not just a corruption of violence that most people, when they read the Bible, they just read that the earth was violent and therefore there's a flood. No, we're talking about a complete violation of the earth, whether or not it's the plant genomes or it's the animal genomes and all these other fabulous beings and things that are recorded in parallel accounts. It says the whole earth was corrupt, not just the violence. And so that's also probably why in the flood story you have in the Noah account where God brings the animals to the ark, because those are the ones that haven't been corrupted as representative species onto the ark to start the world again.
Do you think there was really an ark?
Yes, I do. I do, because again, it is a story that's told on all continents and all cultures and all mythologies. And again, there's a couple of different perspectives on the ark story. So if you look at the oldest surviving one, which is the Epic of Gilgamesh. You have Gilgamesh, who is two-thirds god and one-third human. And he's either created before or after the flood, but in the story, he's born after the flood, even though on the Qumran Dead Sea Scroll documents on 4Q531 through 534, you've got Gilgamesh's name mentioned. But he's told in the Gilgamesh story that he is born after the flood, as is Enkidu, who is also two-thirds god and one-third human, and these are Nephilim, right? And Gilgamesh tells the story to Enkidu about the flood story, and this is about Upnaptishtim or Ziazudra, depending on which translation that you're going to read from, who survives the flood with his family, and he is two-thirds god and one-third human, as what all of the other family members are. And he's the archetypical Nephilim king ruling at the time of the flood. So this is a parallel account or an alteration of what's in the Genesis account. And I think it's more likely a parallel account of a giant survival story. Mm-hmm. Just as when you go into Greek mythology, you have Deucalion and Pyrrha as the Noah figures, and Deucalion is the son of Prometheus, and Prometheus is both a titan and a titan god. So again, you have another Nephilim surviving the flood. So again, that's another parallel account, but from the polytheist religions as opposed to the monotheist religions.
Will we know most of us that somebody is the Antichrist?
Yeah, I think so. If you're willing to look for the signs, right? And if you're prepared to accept the incredible story that was foretold.
Right.
But if you're wanting to accept the message of you're going to live forever as a human God in this world, you're probably going to let your objectivity mislead you. But any time that somebody's going to come to you and offer you godhood, but you have to take a mark and swear loyalty to Yeah, don't do it. I mean, it just seems like a no-brainer, but that's exactly what happens en masse. Humankind accepts that mark.
Well, that's true. Gary, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with phone calls and stories for you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.